Hi, welcome to this week's program. Today I want to share a few pointers on how ordinary salaried folk with regular mid-level jobs can change their financial habits and accelerate their way into sizably higher savings. As many of my regular listeners know, I'm a big fan of the power of compounding, and my advice to everyone who wants to invest is the sooner the better, which leads me to my first tip. Number one is good savers start early. Many good savers were taught as children to sock away money for a rainy day, but good savers who weren't lucky enough to have been taught this early money lesson know when to jump on an opportunity to save. As soon as they see they have an option that increases their savings, like a retirement savings plan through work, they take it. And good savers don't procrastinate making financial decisions. And good savers have retirement accounts. You know, this may seem obvious, but I'm constantly surprised by the number of middle-aged Americans that should, but do not have retirement accounts. So if you don't have one, I suggest you immediately get one and deposit at least 10% of your paycheck each month straight into a retirement account. And good savers know the difference between wants and needs. You know, one of the biggest lies we're sold by marketers today is that wants are actually needs. For example, I may love an Apple product, but I often wonder if most people who buy an iPhone really need one. Or could they do with a reasonably good, fully featured smartphone for less than half the price of an iPhone? I've also had so many clients tell me that travel, new clothes, and eating out are real needs, but they're really not. Instead, good savers make a list of their basic needs, their wants, and their big wishes, and their frugal living helps them save big without really giving up on life's pleasures. I think a lot of this has to do with training your mindset and self-discipline, and while it's hard to start doing so, good savers are committed to sticking to their needs with only occasional indulgence to their wants. Sort of like Warren Buffett, who still lives in the house he bought in 1958 for $31,500. Most people's idea of wealth isn't someone who has $1 million in the bank. It's if someone spends like a millionaire. And too often, people confuse the trappings of wealth with actual wealth. And Buffett is a clear example, someone who you cannot tell what someone is worth just by looking at his or her house or car or clothes. And I know that Buffett still buys clothes off the rack. And I think he had this old Buick or something. He finally got himself a Caddy or something. I think he could buy a lot more, surely, if he wanted to. Moreover, possessions don't bring happiness. And Warren Buffett wrote in his giving pledge, "Some material things may make my life more enjoyable. Many, however, would not. Too often, a vast collection of possessions ends up possessing the owner. The asset I value most, aside from health, is interesting, diverse, and long-standing friends." All right, now here's one that may surprise you. Good savers don't use bill autopay. Now, I love technology. The internet has been a huge boon for all of us. It's raised our productivity on just about every dimension. It helps us take advantage of fantastic online shopping offers, makes banking easier, and everything that comes along with that. But there is a dark side to it. For example, the advent and convenience of services like autopay make it too easy for money to flow in and out without you really registering what's happening. So good savers tend to use autopay for fixed subscriptions, such as payments for monthly health insurance premiums or fixed newspaper subscriptions, but opt to write physical checks or make one-time payments online on discretionary items, such as credit card bills. Good savers also keep track of receipts and tally up their credit card bill against receipts for spending and things like returns, because mistakes always do happen, and good savers don't want to be the ones they happen to. Even better, good savers write down all their budget, and that leads to my next good saver habit, and that's that good savers have a budget, a real, honest-to-goodness, written chart or spreadsheet that they update and balance regularly. And when I talk to new clients, my first clue that someone has a problem with money is they can't provide their monthly cash flow. They don't know what comes in net. They don't know what goes out net. And they can't tell whether they have an excess at the end of the month or a deficiency at the end of the month. And that's one of the first things that we help them work on. Good savers use cash or they use checks. That's not a hard and fast rule, but good savers often use physical types of money. Research shows that people spend 20% more when they use a credit card because it makes purchasing feel less painful. Handing someone a carefully counted notes or writing out a check provides enough of a mental speed bump to slow down many impulse buys. And good savers prioritize savings. It sounds simple, but one of the best habits that good savers have is simply making saving a priority in their lives. Before spending on anything else, they pay themselves first by putting savings into a retirement or other self-directed savings account to the maximum amount they possibly can. And good savers keep track of the little things. What's a $4 latte here or a 99-cent app there, right? But as we all know, little things can add up to big expenses fairly quickly, often before you even realize what's happening. So good savers track even their tiniest expenses as yet another way of checking impulse purchases and focusing on your needs and wants. And good savers look for deals, and I know a lot of people who do this. Being frugal is a big part of saving money, and good savers are always happy to use coupons, hunt down the best deals, or research all possible options before buying. Good savers think through each purchase and research alternatives, like buying used versus new, comparing competitor prices, looking for coupons, and reading reviews in detail to make sure you're making the right buying decision. For example, did you know that Walmart.com often has lower priced items than you can get in the store, and they'll honor that price difference if you show it to them? Another thing, good savers also refrain from heading to online shopping sites when they're inebriated, because data shows that the wantful spending goes up significantly when people are a little tipsy. So while life will have its ups and downs, a modicum of self-discipline, continuous learning, thinking for yourself, developing good habits, focusing on the long term, and having fun on the journey is what you need to set yourself up for success in life. It's as simple as that. And I want to thank Charlotte Hilton Anderson for her well-organized article on this very subject. And go to stevepomerantz.com to hear this segment again or to pass it on to your family or friends, and also to read the transcripts of this whole program if that's in your interest. stevepomerantz.com. P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z, stevepomerantz.com. As you know, my mission is always to educate my listeners, and I remind you week after week, segment after segment, that we love your questions, because we do. These are complicated times, which makes for complicated topics, and I'm always here to answer them. So if you have questions about your portfolio, your kids' kids, your retirement, your 401k, how to take better care of your family, anything financial on your mind, I'm here with 35 years of experience, and I'd love to help you in any way I can. So go to stevepomerantz.com, go to the contact section, and let me know how we can help. That's stevepomerantz.com. P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z, no T, stevepomerantz.com. And contact us one more time, stevepomerantz.com. This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. I was thinking the other day about great companies and how the expectations when you see a company, especially a relatively new company, start out building a wonderful business. Think about Google or Apple. They all started out as small companies. And you see how, you know, the very, very, very small percentage of them actually succeed. But the ones that do get universal acceptance, and they start making money for their investors, and I think we know the rest of the story. So I started thinking about Uber, which has been in business for about 10 years and has grown worldwide. It's a wonderful service, and yet they're still losing money like crazy. So I was flummoxed. So I thought I would go to someone I thought knows the answers to these kinds of questions, and I've invited him back on my show. His name is Whitney Tilson. He was a hedge fund manager for 2 decades, and he now publishes the Empire Investment Report, something that I subscribe to and recommend to you all to read on a daily and a monthly basis, where he talks about top recommendations, but he also talks about issues like this, about this company and that company and why this is working and why this something is not. And you can get him at empirefinancialresearch.com. I highly recommend it. So he's on the line with me right now. Whitney Tilson, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me back, Steve.
So as I said, I was wondering about Uber, and here you've got, I mean, we've all used it. And for me personally, when I use it, I marvel at its simplicity and what a great technological tool it truly is and how it needed to revolutionize the ride-hailing business, because this idea of trying to get a cab like on a catch-me-if-you-can basis, it just is so inefficient. What are your feelings about the company Uber?
You know, I have mixed feelings, Steve. Generally lean toward the negative side, both as a company and as a stock. But I acknowledge that Uber is a wonderful service. I remember the day my first friend told me about it, trying to get a taxi in New York City after an event. And no taxis were available. Just like the moment it starts to rain, you can't get a taxi.
Yes.
So the creation of Uber has been great for humanity, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. Now, my problems with Uber are numerous. And by the way, I highly recommend the new book called Super Pumped, which was one of the catchphrases of Travis Kalanick, the founder of Uber. He created this very testosterone-driven bro culture mm-hmm. where one of their mantras was, we're super pumped, and they would go out and violate every law and engage in all sorts of reckless behavior. And that's part of my problem with the company. But in fairness, it did create a very large business that has $12 billion in revenues right now that has provided a great service to humanity, right? So that's partly why I have a mixed feeling. Mm-hmm. As a stock, I would highly recommend avoiding it. The company is hemorrhaging money, and I think it's going to continue losing money. And it's not like the stock is down quite a bit since it IPO'd earlier this year. A good cautionary tale about why I tell all individual investors, just avoid all IPOs. I have never bought an IPO in my life, and I was a professional money manager for almost 20 years. Mm-hmm. Just avoid them like the plague. Uber is sort of exhibit A. But it would be one thing, sometimes you can make money investing in busted IPOs. Sure. Where the stock's down 80, 90% from the IPO price, but they're still a viable business. And usually they raised a lot of cash during the IPO, so they're not going to go out of business anytime soon. And you can get a nice recovery on some busted IPOs. The problem with Uber, though, is even though the stock's down, not a ton, but maybe it's been cut in half or so. I forget the price at which they IPO'd and where it was trading the first day. But the company today has a $54 billion market cap. In mm-hmm. other words, it still has one of the largest market caps in the world. So, you know, when you want to be bottom fishing among IPOs, you want a company that sort of got a small market cap where there's a lot of room to grow it.
Well, you know, I do have some of those numbers handy, and it originally came out at an $82 billion valuation, $45 a share. It's now in the low 30s, and that gives it a 50-something billion valuation. But it is a rags to riches story. I mean, 10 years ago, it was an idea, technology was created, and 10 years later, they go public for $82 billion. It's actually magnificent in and of itself, that whole idea.
Yeah, it is pretty remarkable that in less than a decade, an idea can turn into a $54 billion market cap company that operates all over the world and is providing an incredibly valuable service to millions of people every day. So I don't want to denigrate the entrepreneurial achievement here, but the way in which Uber went about doing it, and the book Super Pumped reveals a lot of this better than anything that's ever been revealed before. You know, they were operating when they opened up down in Brazil. 16 of their drivers were literally murdered. And the company because Brazil's sort of the Wild West, and you've got people operating in very dangerous areas. But it took way too long for Uber to start requiring people to prove their identity when they signed up for the app, for example.
Yeah.
And some really, you know, there was a bribery scandal in India when regulators were cracking down on the company. The bro culture that was so toxic to women, you know, at headquarters and in many of their offices. So that's why I say I have very mixed feelings about the company, and I have very clear feelings about the stock.
Yeah, we'll talk about that in a minute. In that Amazon Prime documentary about Uber, the documentary spent a lot of time in Australia, where Uber is incredibly popular and incredibly successful. But it really described in detail how they bullied their way into the marketplace through apps, being able to target drivers of other companies, of cab driving companies, to enlist them to join Uber, to give them cash benefits and other things, but really breaking all of the laws set up to regulate the ride-hailing business. And yet they were able to do that consistently, and through manipulating the app and targeting who the regulators were, they were able to create a kind of a gray app where if a regulator were to try to hail a ride, they would see no cars available for them.
Yes, yes.
But of course, the Uber spokesman didn't know anything about that, and any other practices that were egregious of that nature, she would say, well, that happened before I joined and we don't do that anymore. But it was this consistent breaking of the law which really caught my attention, making it quite an unfair playing field for those who were actually trying to work within the law. And I think this goes from country to country. I don't know what they're doing now, of course, but they've got a lot of problems and a lot of headwinds, because basically Uber says that they're just a technology company, that they're not a ride-hailing company, and therefore their drivers are not really working. They're not employees of Uber.
Yes. I mean, you've hit upon a number of distinct but related issues. The first being how they tried to put Lyft out of business in the U.S. and some of their other competitors. They engaged in very nefarious, underhanded tactics, not necessarily illegal. That remains to be determined. So that's issue one. Issue two is how they thumbed their noses at regulators in cities across the United States and in countries around the world, often engaging in blatantly violating the law when they were instructed to shut down or not to open in a city. They just did so anyway. And then, as you pointed out, they used various technology tricks to make sure that the regulators could not enforce the law. And then the third issue, that there's now been a sort of a regulatory blowback. And for example, in their largest single market, the state of California, where they initially launched, the legislature just passed a law mandating that not just Uber, but all of these gig economy companies, from Lyft to DoorDash, et cetera, that their employees that are actually delivering the service have to be considered employees, not contractors. And that means they have to pay various benefits and payroll taxes, et cetera. The estimates I've seen would increase Uber's costs by 30%. And keep in mind, this is a business that is already losing hideous and accelerating amounts of money to then have by far their biggest cost rise by 30%. I think could bankrupt them very quickly. Now, keep in mind, this is only California.
Yeah.
Uber is still maintaining, oh, this law doesn't apply to us, when in fact the law was specifically written to cover Uber, because Uber has such a bad reputation and behaved so badly over the years that the legislators, particularly in California, but I suspect in other areas, you know, have no love for Uber and are happy to pass these laws, which I think could bankrupt Uber in fairly short order if this becomes widespread.
I think a lot of people listening now have owned businesses and understand this idea of what truly makes an employee and what truly makes an independent contractor. As a matter of fact, in California, the Supreme Court set a strict new test. They call it the ABC test, to determine who qualifies as an independent contractor. And here they are. Here it is. A worker has to be free from the hirer's direction and control. B, the work is outside the hirer's usual business. And C, the worker is engaged in a customarily independent trade. So let's say I was a bookkeeper and I had numerous clients and I did a job for an employer. Am I an independent contractor or an employee? Well, am I under the hirer's direction and control as far as my hours and so on? Am I outside the usual business? Well, if I'm a bookkeeper, that business could be a pizza restaurant. They're not in the bookkeeping business, so I would be outside their usual business. And if a worker is engaged in a customarily independent trade, meaning I have numerous employers, then I would be considered independent. In the case of Uber, doesn't seem like they meet that test.
Yeah, I mean, look, there's enough gray area here that reasonable people could disagree on it. Some Uber drivers are clearly independent contractors. They just do it a few hours a week. They have another full-time job, etc. But there are plenty of people now whose primary occupation is doing this. And by the way, most people who do it have both Uber and Lyft and maybe some other app, but those would be the two big ones.
Also, do those drivers work for Lyft as well? Some of them?
Well, when you say work for Lyft,
drive,
they contract for Lyft.
Contract.
You know, it's sort of funny. I often strike up a conversation with whoever I'm driving, and I use both Uber and Lyft.
Yeah.
And almost always, they just have both apps. And if someone's using the Lyft app and needs somebody, they'll go pick them up. And if they're using the Uber app, they go pick them up. Doesn't make really any difference.
Yeah.
And this gets to one of your questions in your opening remarks, which is, you know, how is this incredibly well-known company that's collecting $12 billion in revenue, et cetera, how come they're losing so much money? You'd think they'd be real profitable, given that they currently, anyway, don't have to consider all these drivers as employees and pay them benefits. And they really are, for now anyway, more of a technology company. They're just connecting the people like you and me who need a ride with people who are providing the ride, and they just take a fee, right? You'd think that would be the world's greatest business. And the answer, though, in part is what we were just talking about, which is, well, if you could just as well use Lyft. In other words, there's almost perfect competition out there. And, you know, because almost all drivers, they drive for both Uber and Lyft, Uber and Lyft are in this cutthroat competitive battle to reduce the price to you and me, the customers, but also there's a lot of competition for drivers. So they got to pay drivers more and give us a bargain price, not just competing against Uber and Lyft, but of course, just competing against regular taxis and other forms of transportation, right? So they're getting squeezed on all sides. So what initially you might think is a good business really isn't. It's a pretty terrible business.
Well, one of the key factors when reading like a Warren Buffett is to look for a moat, a high barrier to entry.
Yes.
So when you're looking at a company that makes ice cream, let's say, I mean, it's not hard for someone to buy the machines and, you know, to produce ice cream or yogurt or whatever it is, frozen yogurt. That's a low barrier to entry. And what you're basically saying is, I mean, the taxi companies are not sitting idle. They're creating their own apps now. You have a Lyft. So, okay, so it's a low barrier of entry. So that's a mark against them. But what is causing all these losses? Now, I realize when you do an IPO, you give out a lot of stock and stock options and things like that to reward early investors and your employees. So is much of their losses right now just kind of paper losses? Because that's not really a cash expense.
Yeah, it's a good question. The answer is it's both. In the past 12 months, the company reported net income on the income statement of minus $8.1 billion.
Yeah.
But $4 billion of that was non-cash stock-based compensation. So when you consider whether a company might go bankrupt, you don't care about the non-cash stuff.
Yeah.
What you're really looking at is how much cash they have left and how much they're burning at what rate, and can they access more cash or get that burn down. So the number I prefer to look at is over the past 12 months, they had $2.7 billion of operating cash flow losses. That's real cash.
Right.
And then they had to spend $626 million on capital expenditures. That was real cash. So you got to look at the cash flow statement, not the income statement.
Right.
So that's 3.4 billion. Now, that in and of itself isn't, they have 11 billion in cash and about 6 billion in debt. So call it, they have 5 billion of net cash. And in the past 12 months, they burned 3.4 billion, which means they got a little over a year worth of cash left. The question though is that burn rate going down? And it is for Lyft. Lyft last quarter reported its first ever operating cash flow positive quarter, a mere $15 million, yeah. And they had CapEx, so it was still some cash burn if you count CapEx. But turning operating cash flow positive is a big step for an emerging company like this. Whereas Uber, the losses are accelerating. So that's why I think, you know, Uber is in a much worse position than Lyft.
Yeah, so a situation in which a company is burning cash, it's kind of a race to the finish, in a sense, to see whether your cash hoard, the amount you have in the bank, is going to, how long that's going to last versus your spending.
Yes.
But it doesn't take into account the fact that you have people and institutions that are willing to come in and continue to fund the company by investing $500 million and $1 billion. I mean, PayPal invested $500 million before the IPO. I forget the company, but another company invested $1 billion in their autonomous car research project and so on. It's almost like a multi-level marketing scheme. You know, it works until people turn around and they go, oh, this is really not a good business. I'm going to stop the flow. I'm going to stop investing. Has that inflection point?
Right. It's a confidence game.
Confidence.
And if investors believe in the long-term model, look at Amazon, for example, in its early years, it burned a lot of capital, but investors saw a brilliant entrepreneur, rapid growth, a long-term growth runway. And so they were willing to provide debt and equity capital to fund those losses as Amazon looked to go for market share and growth rather than current profitability. And the investors who provided that capital have been richly rewarded, you know, to the tune of 10 to 100 times their money or more, right?
Right.
So the question, it is not irrational at all for public or private market investors to invest in companies that have been chronically been losing money and probably will lose money for the next few years, because if there's going to be an inflection point at some point in the future and the company becomes very profitable. But the things you want to see is you want to see a great business model, a very light business model. Think of software as a service kind of companies, right? But you also want to see a trend line of the company at least losing less and less money over time, right? Yeah. And in that case, that is true of Lyft. It's not true of Uber. And obviously, you want to see a valuation that's low enough that you can make a lot of money to the upside if you're right. And again, Uber's still sitting here with a $50+ billion valuation.
And losing money.
That just doesn't give you the kind of 2, 3, 5, 10 times your money upside scenarios that you look for if you're going to take the risk of investing in a money losing business.
My guest, Whitney Tilson, hedge fund manager for 2 decades. Also, for more of this type of banter and on a regular basis, go to empirefinancialresearch.com and sign up for his daily letter. I get it every single day and really like it very much. That's Empire Financial Research. And while you're there, while you're thinking about this anyway, make sure you go and visit our website, which is stevepomerantz.com. Don't forget, we love to get your questions. And also you can say, hey, Alexa, play the Steve Pomerantz Show, and we will appear right there on your Alexa device. But come to stevepomerantz.com and sign up for our weekly update as well. That's stevepomerantz.com. Whitney, hey, thanks for spending so much time and trying to elucidate this Uber story.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, and look forward to doing it again.
Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes on the hillside, little boxes all the same. There's a pink one and a green one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all out of ticky-tacky, and they all look just the same.
You're listening to the Steve Pomerantz Show. It's time for Real Estate Roundup. This is the time every single week we get together with noted real estate agent Terry Story. Terry is a 31-year veteran with Keller Williams located in Boca Raton, Florida. Welcome back to the show, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
31 years.
31 years.
Hooray for you. Congratulations.
Still here.
So, you know, in my simple mind, there are two kinds of homes that you can buy. You can buy new construction or you can buy a used home.
New or used.
New or used, right?
Yeah.
And each has its benefits and each has its drawbacks. Let's talk about purchasing brand new construction.
Okay, great.
Well, one of the reasons people would do that is they know that they're not buying into someone else's problems.
Right.
Or shoddy repairs or cheap replacements.
They can make it their way, right?
And you can see everything from scratch.
They like the shiny object, shiny white object.
Does a new house smell like a car? So anyways, but purchasing a new construction house or whatever you're buying can be more complicated at times.
It can be more complicated. And one of the things you also have to realize, a lot of the builders, they're not building inventory houses to let them sit there. Like I just did a new construction deal and it's not going to close till like next year.
Yeah.
You know, if you're interested in new construction, be it you have a house built, or you're going through, you know, a big developer, a lot of times you're going to be waiting. So know if you're thinking that,
yeah,
this is, could be a year, year and a half out.
It reminds me of my older clients used to say to me, they don't even buy green bananas. I can't even imagine buying a place and it's going to be done, you know, like 12 months.
Yeah,
from
you
now.
Forget about it.
You forget about
it's
it.
It's like, oh, wait a minute. I think I have a house coming here sometime soon.
Exactly right. And you know that neighborhood that they're just putting up across the street, that looks so much better.
Right, exactly.
Okay, so that's not what we're here to talk about. So number one of the issues is that you're likely, everybody listening to me, you are more than likely to pay more than the advertised price.
Oh, no question. So the, you know, the billboard will say starting at $499.
Yeah.
Okay. So you walk in, it's like, well, where's that $499 house? It doesn't exist. It may on paper start there. It's like, oh, you want a lot with it? You want the house to sit on a piece of property? Well, let me show you what's available. Well, for $50,000, you can have this.
That's the house that backs up to the turnpike.
Well, no, well, they don't even, there's an upgrade because, you know, there's no backyard neighbors. That lot.
Oh, I never knew that. I hope you're not right about that. No,
I'm exaggerating a little bit, but recognize that those numbers there, there's a lot more to it.
Right? Well, I mean, you always hear about these nightmares about, you see the tile that comes with it, and then you see the upgraded tile, and you go, oh.
Just a little bit more.
I have to have that. Right. I'm going to be in here for 20 years.
Oh, and don't think those model homes are all standard.
Oh, that's for sure.
They're trying to sell you.
Oh, okay.
And not all cases. I mean, there are builders that do display some of their standard features, but, you know, it's a little tongue in cheek. But just realize that, especially some of these really nice models, they're all Mac Daddied out.
They are. So the idea here is when you go in to buy one of these things, make sure that you have a cushion of extra money to spend because you're going to be spending.
Right.
It. Okay.
Right. The builders like to tell you, well, we just want to show you what options there could be.
Yeah. I know. It's the anchoring sale. I talk about that with you guys, real estate agents, a lot. You know, I want to buy a $450,000 house. Okay, well, let me show you the $700,000 house first. You know?
Then we'll work our way down.
We'll work our way down. Well, I can't go back. I love that $700,000. All right. So also, you know, the builder is going to recommend or not pressure you, but entice you to use their lender.
Sure.
Well, how does that work?
So, you know, basically what the lender, and it's good for the lender if you're using his lender in that he knows what's going on with your finances. It's not going out to a third party. And as a matter of fact, he's willing to pay you an incentive to use their lender. So the key thing to this is knowing that you're not required. And the lenders that they use, there's nothing wrong with them. They're not charging you a higher rate or anything like that. It's truly the builder's desire to stay in control of what's going on with the process. Because again, he took out the construction loan.
Yes.
He's now building this house.
On
spec. He's on your spec.
Yeah.
Even though it's, you know, not complete spec. But,
that's right.
You know, so there's risk on his part and he's just trying to minimize his exposure and risk.
Okay. What about using a real estate agent?
Oh, you should absolutely use a real estate agent. What you have to understand with these new construction, I'll give you an example. A builder's building 100 homes. he factors that, say, I don't know, I'm going to make up the numbers, 85% of the consumers are going to come in with their real estate agent. So when he calculates his cost, he's calculating paying, you know, all 100 homes based on a realtor coming in. So if you're one of those that go in without a realtor, you're not saving the commission.
He's making the commission.
Making
so he may suggest, you know, you really don't need an agent here. Let's say you don't have one.
Right.
Because it's more money in his pocket. If he's going to be paying 20 grand to an agent, he'd rather keep the 20 grand without having to pay
sure.
it. But either way, it's built into the price.
It's built into the price. You're not saving any money. But why wouldn't you want somebody to be on your side as an advocate?
I was going to ask that. So tell me, what is the value of having an agent on new construction?
Well, I'll tell you, the agent on new construction, A, will know a lot about the different builders, because they, especially if they're experienced, they've been in town for a long time. They know their reputation and can bring you through the pitfalls. When it comes to like the contract, there's not much that you can do with the builder's contract.
Right.
He's not going to alter it. You can even send it to an attorney. Good luck. They're not going to make any changes. But the realtor is there on your side. Actually, I think one of the best benefits that we bring to the table is help you not make stupid decisions. And when I say that, I just had a buyer at a new construction place, and we're looking at the different lots. Well, you know, she's in love with the $150,000 lot, and I just brought it to her attention. I said, you know, when it comes to resale, you're not going to get back $150,000. You're paying for that now. You'll get a premium when you go to sell your house, but it's not going to be $150,000.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's things that a realtor can just ground you a little bit and help you make wise decisions.
Right. But also, you have a full view of the lay of the land.
Right.
So this community over that community, based upon maybe you want to be near the turnpike because you work down in Miami or something like that.
Exactly.
You kind of have the big picture, so a realtor can bring
and
that
And they
too.
Can help steer you. You know, sometimes you didn't even know that you want a new construction, but they start to feel like, you know what, maybe
yeah.
new construction is good for you because you've been looking at all these resales.
Yeah.
Where we have a hard time as agents is when a consumer goes and looks at these new construction places, and then I take them to go look at used homes.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, they're just like flabbergasted.
It's the anchoring again.
Yep.
Okay. My guest, as always, is Terry Story, a 31-year veteran with Keller Williams, located in Boca Raton, Florida, and she can be found at terrystory.com. Thanks, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
Are there any topics we're missing, guests we haven't thought of that you'd like on the show, questions you want answered? Contact us anytime at stevepomeranz.com. That's Steve, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z.com. Simply go to stevepomeranz.com and click Contact to write us anytime, anywhere. Articles on the site you liked or didn't? Want to share your 2 cents? Comment on any of our guest interviews and tell us. You know, this show's purpose is to empower and protect you on all things financial. We'd love to hear your feedback so we can make sure we're getting you the information you need to live your one best financial life. Contact us at any time at stevepomeranz.com. That's Steve, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z.com. This is the Steve Pomeranz Show, and I'm Steve Pomeranz. I want to welcome to the show Bob Neat. He's an award-winning journalist who lives in Northern Virginia, and he's come up with a great list on ways to earn extra cash for this holiday season. Welcome back to the show, Bob.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Appreciate it.
So, in your article, you wrote 17 ways to earn extra cash for the holidays, and I was really astonished at the clever number of ways that people can pick up, so, you know, hundreds of extra bucks and maybe thousands of extra bucks and maybe even find something to take them through the next year. So let's just get started. The first one, sell unwanted electronics. Take us through it.
Yes, there are several ways to sell your unwanted electronics. We all have these sitting around our houses and when we upgrade to something new and we don't trade it in. But there are ways to get rid of them. There are several sites. One you might be familiar with is GameStop.com.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good one to use. And there are also two others. One's called NextWorth.com, and another is called USell.com. U-S-E-L-L.
U-S-E-L-L. Yeah. Okay.
Yes, USell. And you can sell your smartphones, tablets, game consoles, video games, textbooks, all kinds of things.
Okay, great.
You get paid by check, and shipping is free.
Mm. So if you're listening to this, why don't you grab a pen? Bob just mentioned GameStop.com, like the store, NextWorth.com, and USell with the letter U and the word sell. What about Gazelle.com? I know that's here on your list.
That's another one. That's definitely a good one, too.
Okay. Yeah, you know, I have an old iPad. I've got three or four old phones, and I'm always afraid to send them in because, you know, I'm afraid that even if I try to clear it, it's going to still have some information there.
Yeah, that's a scary thing. As a matter of fact, the Apple website has a way. They'll show you how to clear your Apple devices
mm-hmm. okay.
before you send them in. And in fact, Apple has a trade-in program, too, where they'll reward you if you trade in a newer type of an Apple product.
Yeah, they can still resell, I suppose.
Right, exactly.
Okay, mm-hmm. Let's move on. Search for unclaimed property.
This is a good one, and I actually tried it, and of course I didn't find anything.
Yeah.
You can go to a couple of state sites or the IRS and see if there's money out there that's in your name, like mm-hmm. deposits for uncollected insurance benefits, deposits on utilities, things like that. It's just it's very interesting. I found some of my relatives on there, so that was a pretty good thing.
Oh, that's nice. You know, usually what happens too is that if you actually do have some money hanging out there that you don't know about, you'll probably get a letter from a lawyer who wants to then go after on your behalf and to claim it for you. And they'll take a percentage of what they're able to recover for you. Of course, if you just look at yourself and then you contact the various agency, you can just go direct. But a lot of times people hear about these because they get a letter from a lawyer. As a matter of fact, when my dad passed away many years ago, he passed away totally broke. But about 2 years later, we found that he had $7,000 sitting in a bank account out somewhere in California, and we split it up amongst the family. So that's a real thing. It's pretty interesting.
Oh, great story. Great story, yeah.
Thanks. How about adjusting your tax withholding?
Very, very easy thing to do. All you have to do is go to your HR department, have them fix your W-2 form, through your W-4. And we also, on our website, kiplinger.com, we have a withholding calculator that you can figure out for you personally, how much withholding less or withholding more would affect your paycheck.
Yeah, so that's really very important because I think you wrote that the average person gets $3,000 back per year. And, you know, we're kind of against that idea of using the government as your savings account, but that's the way a lot of people do it. So if you can adjust your tax withholding, I think you're better off.
Yeah, the money's going into your pocket every week instead of being, you know, held for you and being spent by the government.
Yeah, exactly. But also, you have to have the discipline to be able to not spend it and, you know, to save a portion of what you're making. Because let's face it, folks, you're never going to retire. You're never going to get anywhere unless you take a portion of your salary and get it saved for the long term. That's a completely different segment, Bob. I'm not going there.
Okay.
I did want to mention. But I want to talk about some of the other more unusual parts of this list. One is be a tour guide. Tell me about that.
That is very cool. I found some interesting things out with that. I had known about these tour guides and how they make money through an organization called the Licensed Battlefield Guides of Gettysburg. I'm a history buff and I've utilized them before. To become something like that, though, you have to be tested and certified by the National Park Service. And it's a very grueling learning curve to do that. But the reward, there's upsides for the rewards that you get from that.
Mm-hmm.
But another really interesting thing is running tours. You can become a running tour guide.
What does that mean?
There's an organization called City Running Tours, and people sign up for a running tour, people who run, and you'll take running tours of, say, the monuments in mm-hmm. Washington, D.C. And if you're a tour guide, you get paid $20 to $25 per tour plus tips.
Okay. Wow. You mentioned here that there's a White House tour, led by a member of the White House Press Corps. And also you mentioned a travel guide site called Viable.
Viable, I think it's called.
Viable. V-A-Y-A-B-L-E. That lets anyone list a tour or experience that tells a unique story about a destination, from its art to the history of food. And you found this out at the Licensed Battlefield Guides of Gettysburg. And of course, you're going to have to be certified because they want to make sure you know your stuff. It's kind of like when you're volunteering in a museum and you want to be a docent. Usually they put you through a pretty, you know, extensive course.
Absolutely.
So you can learn what you're talking about. How about getting paid for your opinions? You know, I have a lot of opinions and talk about them on the radio. What about other people getting paid?
There are organizations out there. One you've probably heard of is called the Harris Poll.
Mm-hmm.
They reward people for taking online and phone surveys, sometimes between $50 and $100 and $200 for some of these opinion seekers. One is called Inspired Opinions. And as I mentioned, the Harris Poll.
Yeah.
Another is Focus Point Global.
Mm-hmm.
But aside from that, speaking of opinions, you can also become an online juror.
Oh, wow.
And get paid for that.
Yeah. So what is that? It's an attorney that wants to kind of pretest.
Yes.
A particular case, and they want to get opinions to see kind of how the general public would react.
Right.
Uh-huh.
Bear in mind, you're not actually a juror on an actual jury duty.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a mock jury.
Yeah, yeah, and they're willing to pay for that. That's really cool. I didn't know about that.
I know.
Whatsoever.
And it adds up.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, good. By the way, all of these sites will be listed on our website, which is stevepomerantz.com. That's P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z, stevepomerantz.com. You can hear this segment again and again and again to get the names of all these sites. If you go to stevepomerantz.com, this will all be posted there when you're ready to look for it. So very good. All right, let's skip around. I like this one here. Join a street team. What is that?
Yes. It's a promotional. You've seen these people out handing out brochures and promoting films. I was going to a concert recently and they were promoting, I forget what movie it was right now, but they had like hats and posters and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
This person was hired by the film company to distribute this information. Products.
Right. But that's not the same as me spinning a sign on some corner, getting people to, yeah. I guess, how come that's not on your list, Bob? Sign spinners.
Oh, did you do that?
No.
Okay.
I feel sorry for those people. Some of them seem to be having fun. Many really don't.
Hey, you know, some of those guys are really thoroughly trained to spin those signs around.
Okay.
And it's pretty amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, there's a new store that opened up near me and they sell hot dogs and there's this poor guy who stands out there in a hot dog suit.
No.
All day. And that's just sad. You know, it's just basically sad. So we talked about joining a street team. And so how would you find that kind of a job?
Of course, there's a website. It's called streetteampromotion.com.
Okay. Yeah, well, that makes sense. Yeah, good. That's mm-hmm. a great idea. All right. Be a babysitter. I mean, that's not too out there, but we're talking about adults as well as kids, I guess, here, right?
Yes, sure. Babysitter or a nanny. And rates vary from small cities to larger cities, but you can make some pretty good change, plus the aforementioned tips as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. My guest is Bob Neat. He's with Kiplinger.com. And we're talking about 17 ways to earn extra cash for the holidays. I'm not sure we'll get to all 17. But another one here is sell excess furniture. Well, okay, sure.
Craigslist is always a place to sell your excess furniture, whether you're moving out or moving on or just have this extra furniture that's been sitting around your house or in your attic.
You know, let's face it, we all accumulate stuff.
Too much.
Too much. You know, we move into a house that you know fits us. There's extra room. And within 3 to 5 years, you know, it's totally stuffed. It's time to let some of this stuff go, right?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. You grow your possessions to the size of your house. Definitely.
That's right. Exactly. So you either have to sell your stuff or you have to move. And it's cheaper. It's better to sell your stuff.
Absolutely.
Okay. So Craigslist, any other ideas with regards to selling online furniture, let's say?
Consignment.
Mm-hmm.
Consignment is a good place to go, too. There are private consignment shops around your town, I'm sure.
Yeah, there are.
Mm-hmm. There are online furniture consignments as well.
Really?
One is called Cherish, and that's spelled with the chair, C-H-A-I. thair-ish .com.
Okay.
And some of these sites are kind of limited to different markets. Like this, there's one called Apt Deco for apartment, APT Deco. And that's mostly New York City as well as Washington, D.C. You can find it there.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. But I never thought of selling furniture online. So I'm going to take a look at this Cherish site. That's pretty interesting. But I actually personally use consignment shops all the time when I'm selling excess art or, you know, there's just something I want to get rid of. And I've been very successful in getting some money back for this stuff. And what I can't sell and what doesn't actually fit or will be accepted in a consignment store, I give away to charity.
Yes, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Good point.
All right. What about you've accumulated some reward points? What do you do with those?
You cash them in. For example, I have an Amazon credit card where I get my points go toward Amazon purchases and they add up. And every time I get them accumulated, I knock them off when I'm checking out something on Amazon.com.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot of rewards points that just go uncollected. People just don't cash them in.
Yeah. You mentioned here, on average, about $205 worth of rewards per year that aren't redeemed. That's too bad. That's kind of foolish.
Per household, yeah, definitely. Yeah.
You know, I personally like these cash back cards. Like the credit card I use gives me double cash back. So
nice.
I want cash. I don't really want points.
You don't want points.
I don't really want points. You know, I think when you get points, you're vulnerable to point inflation. Meaning that the company that's giving you the points can make them less valuable over time, meaning it takes more points to get the same thing.
Right.
When I get cash, I guess I'm subject to the inflation rate, the general inflation rate of the country, which is pretty low. So I'm willing to accept that. And anyway, I want control. I want cash. So that's what I recommend.
Nice.
All right. What about, let's see what we got here. Walking dogs. Well, you know, we see people do that, but is that really, are those jobs hard or easy to get?
Well, you can do it on your own. You can start your own business. There are people in my neighborhood I see, they're just walking all kinds of different dogs all day long. And, you know, you can get, depending on what your fee is, $15 to $30 an hour.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And you're getting exercise along with the dogs as well.
Yeah, you mentioned here that a good way to advertise your services is to go to veterinarian offices and maybe put up a little poster or cards or something.
Yeah, sure, definitely. And they're usually open to that as well.
Mm-hmm. All right, here's another one. Sell your creations. If you have a knack for creating anything from baked goods to intricate art designs, you can profit from your talent. Do you have some websites for us there?
Yes. Of course, there's Etsy. That's a pretty well-known
website
for artwork. There's another one called, you know, Tumblr as well. That's a site that where you can mostly sell art prints.
Mm-hmm. I didn't actually know that. I mean, I've heard of Tumblr, but I've never actually used it. T-U-M-B-L-R.
Right.
That's Tumblr. Mm-hmm.
And Zazzle, Z-A-Z-Z-L-E.
Okay.
That's another site.
Right.
And also, you know, just going to church functions, farmers markets, craft shows, places like that, you can make some money doing that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, we only have time for one more, so I'm going to choose Drive Other People.
Drive Other People, yes.
Yeah. Tell us about that.
There's some nice cash there. You know, the usual sites are Uber and Lyft. If you go to those websites, you'll see what the requirements are.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is, you set your own hours and when you want to work. And now they're playing with some models of tipping the drivers as well. So there's a little extra cash in that as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're using your own car, and I guess you're using your own gas, and they're paying you, what, about $19 an hour?
Right.
So you got to kind of have to factor in the wear and tear on your car and all that.
You do have to. And there have been some critics saying that, you know, you should take a real hard look at how much you're actually going to make from this.
Yeah. I can see that it's not all that it's cracked up to be, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. My guest is Bob Neat. We've been talking about ways to make extra cash for the holidays. And don't forget, you can hear all these websites again by going to our website, which is stevepomerantz.com. That's P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z, stevepomerantz.com. And sign up for our weekly update, too, because we always have these segments and all kinds of segments. We think they're very interesting, and you can listen to the show on a per-segment basis if there's something in particular that interests you or, of course, listen to the whole show as you wish. We also have summaries of the segments as well, so you can read about what we said. We try to be as total purpose or all purpose as we can when you come to our website. Hey, Bob, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Steve. My pleasure.
Are you anxious about your financial future? Have you ever made money decisions you've regretted and then repeated the same mistake again? Or perhaps you avoid talking about money altogether? Life is unpredictable, but your decisions don't have to be. And knowing where you stand and having an ongoing action plan will help you get where you want to go. So when you understand that the cornerstone of success is in making good decisions coupled with deliberate action, you can start on the road to ensuring that you're investing the way you should and feel good that you're taking care of yourself and your family in the best possible way. And you know, this has been the mission of the Steve Pomerantz Show from the very beginning. So once again, I want to remind you that you can ask us anything on your mind financially by visiting stevepomerantz.com. And if you have more serious concerns or questions, I'll personally take the time to get back to you to help you find a solution. I've been helping people do just that for 35 years, helping them get ready for retirement, save for a house or college, and so many of life's turning points. So once again, go to stevepomerantz.com and click on Contact. That's stevepomerantz.com.
Investment advisory services are offered through United Capital Financial Advisors, a registered investment advisor. United Capital and the Steve Pomerantz Show are separate and unrelated companies.
I'd like to take a moment to thank all the people involved in the making of this show. Senior producer Erica Stamolo, engineer Brian Zykowitz, senior editor Carol Malzone, and John Sova, who handles our digital platform. And of course, finally, contributor Terry Story. Any interviewee's appearance on the Steve Pomerantz Show does not represent any endorsement or confer any opinion whatsoever, either positive or negative, by the Steve Pomerantz Show or any media by which the Steve Pomerantz Show is distributed. Thank you so much for joining us.
Investing involves risk, and listeners should carefully consider their own investment objectives and never rely on any single chart, graph, or marketing piece to make decisions. The radio show is intended for informational purposes only, is not a recommendation to buy or sell any securities, and should not be considered tax, legal, investment advice. Please contact your tax, legal, financial professional with questions about your specific needs and circumstances. The information in the show is obtained from sources believed to be reliable. However, their accuracy and completeness cannot be guaranteed. All data are driven from publicly available information and has not been independently verified by United Capital. Neither United Capital nor any of its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this recording, and any liability as a result of this recording is expressly disclaimed. This recording should not be relied upon to evaluate any potential transaction. United Capital is not giving tax, legal, investment advice by means of this recording, and this recording does not establish a client relationship with United Capital.